Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
That's the second time it's gone off.
They never go home, those boys.
The second captain's
world service.
That's... Yeah. They have asked for that, really.
Well, you can laugh. I'm the World Cup.
I'm a little bit of an idealist. But having said that, I want to be like me.
Last Thursday, we arrived home from our second captain's 10-year anniversary trip to New York to find the football and political scene in the UK dominated by the Gary Lineker situation. Ken managed to get his head around it in time to chat to Peter Gagan, editor-in-chief of Open Democracy. While thanking his guest at the end of that interview, Ken mentioned almost in passing, we probably haven't heard the last of this issue. Never was a truer word spoken. Welcome to Monday's Football Podcast. Hey Ken, hey Murph.
Hello.
Hey, how's it going?
Since that Thursday pod, Lineker was stood down from presenting duties. Many BBC colleagues then chose to step down in solidarity. The BBC became engulfed in its worst crisis in many years, as I've seen it described. Match of the Day and Match of the Day 2 went ahead without the theme music, most shockingly of all, of course, without presenters, pundits, commentators, minimal graphics, not a huge amount of bells and whistles. And now finally, on Monday morning, we have Lineker tweeting that he's back this week. Whew, quite a few developments. You weren't wrong, Ken. We hadn't heard the last of the story when you finished talking to Peter on Thursday.
Yeah, really amazing stuff. Just such a botch job by the BBC under pressure from the idiot government that they have in the UK. I mean, I see that the Director General Tim Davey, who's obviously got a lot of exposure over the last few days, saying it's a convenient narrative that basically he buckled to political pressure from the Tory party. I mean, it does look like that. You know, it does look like that. You know, I mean, a bunch of them wrote
convenient
a letter.
Convenient doesn't mean wrong, to be fair.
He got a letter from...
It is convenient to read correctly the situation also.
Yeah, sometimes the convenient explanation is the correct one. Yeah, he says that's not true. That's not how he works. So I suppose he must be saying, this is just a massive mistake by me. You know, it's just I'm the one who did this. It was the 36 MPs from something called the Common Sense Group. The Common Sense Group is against wokeness. They wrote a letter saying, this is great. Lineker needs to apologize. When in fact it's Tim Davey who's ended up apologizing, not to Lineker. He hasn't quite gone to the extent of begging forgiveness from Gary Lineker personally. He has apologized in general, to staff, contributors, presenters, and most importantly, our audiences, he says. And I apologize for this. The potential confusion caused by the gray areas of the BBC social media guns that was introduced in 2020 is recognized. I'm going to get matters resolved and our sport content back on air. Impartiality is important to the BBC. It's also important to the public. The BBC has a commitment to impartiality in its charter. and a commitment to freedom of expression. That is a difficult balancing act to get right. It certainly is.
It has proven so in the last few days.
Where people are subject to different contracts and on-air positions and different audiences and social media profiles, BBC's social media guidance is designed to help manage these sometimes difficult challenges. I'm aware there is a need to ensure the guidance is up to this task. It should be clear, proportionate, and appropriate. Accordingly, we are announcing a review led by an independent expert reporting to the BBC on its existing social media guidance, with a particular focus on how it applies to freelancers outside news and current affairs. BBC and myself are aware Gary is in favour of such a review. BBC will announce shortly who will conduct that review. Whilst this work is undertaken, the BBC's current social media guidance remains in place. Gary is a valued part of the BBC. I know how much the BBC means to Gary. I look forward to him presenting our coverage. So when he talks about the social media guidance, there's a difference between guidance and guidelines. Guidelines means rules. Guidance is interpretation of rules. Right. Now, they changed their guidance. Let's hear first. He came in September 2020. Gary Lineker signed a new contract in a couple of weeks later, or was announced that he'd signed the new contract a couple of weeks later. He took a, I believe, £400,000 pay cut at that point, down to £1.35 million, which means he's still the highest paid presenter at the BBC, but less well paid than he was previously. Mm-hmm. They changed the guidance or announced their new social media guidance the following month. And the relevant change for Gary Lineker, this is a paragraph that was not in it before. Well, let's just read. Application to everyone working for the BBC. Individuals working in news and current affairs across all divisions and factual journalism production, along with all senior leaders, have a particular responsibility to uphold the BBC's impartiality through their actions on social media, and so must abide by specific rules set out in this guidance. Factual journalism includes returning strands which cover topical issues such as Country File, The One Show, and Woman's Hour. It does not include, for example, specialist authored or limited documentary series. There are also others. Now, this is the relevant bit. This is the bit that wasn't in there before. There are also others who are not journalists or involved in factual programming who nevertheless have an additional responsibility to the BBC because of their profile on the BBC. We expect these individuals to avoid taking sides on party political issues or political controversies and to take care when addressing public policy matters. This apparently internally was known as the Lineker Clause, because Lineker had already, by the time this guidance was brought in, this updated guidance, he'd already had a bunch of kind of run-ins, let's say, with the government mainly, but also, you know, expressing opinions about, I mean, Brexit was obviously the main thing that he was pissed off about and was frequently expressing opinions about, which were unpopular with the, you know, Brexit government. But also Corbyn, he wasn't a fan of Jeremy Corbyn, and he would express views on that. So, you know, he had a history of expressing views on, let's say, the current political scene, which evidently they wanted to stop. But he kind of felt, well, you know, I mean, I can continue to talk about things. I mean, this is sort of ridiculous. You know, this is kind of, and in terms of what he actually said, by the way, I see quite a lot of the commentary about this is sort of says at some point, oh, well, we all know that, like, what he said was stupid and, you know, he should never have said that. And, you know, it's like a lot of it's, you know, obviously the thing he said was wrong, but, you know, that's not the point. What he actually said was this, right? First of all, he tweeted, "Good heavens, this is beyond awful." And it was over a video of Suella Braverman, the UK Home Secretary, announcing her announcing this new policy, this illegal migration bill. And then someone says something to him, which has since been deleted by the tweet author. Gary Lineker's reply to that, and this is the one that caused the trouble, in particular, he said, there is no huge influx. I assume he was referring here to a huge influx of refugees. "We take far fewer refugees than other major European countries. This is just an immeasurably cruel policy directed at the most vulnerable people in language that is not dissimilar to that used by Germany in the 1930s. And I'm out of order." So that's what he said. And this supposedly is, well, he should never, obviously you shouldn't have said that. And yeah. But hang on a second, you know, what's the claim he's making here?
Well, the 1930s Germany, some of the conversations I've seen, some of the, a lot of people are making the point that you can make the argument, without bringing up, once you bring up Nazi Germany, basically, it just takes, it escalates it to a whole new level, and it brings a lot of heat on what you're saying, whereas you can make the point about how cruel it is and all those sorts of things without bringing up that language. That was basically what you're hearing over the last few days.
Yeah, but the point is that his tweet on the base of it is certainly defensible. Language that is not dissimilar to that used by Germany in the 1930s. Now, I don't like that "by" because, I mean, it implies that Germany was the one saying these words, since we know Germany, you know... You know what I mean? I suppose you could say the German government. But actually, if you look at... have you ever listened to Suella Braverman? Like, I mean, have you ever actually listened to her rhetoric? I mean, she talks about cultural Marxism. You know, she's been criticized for this before. She, you know, it is cultural Marxism. I'm sorry, but if you're talking about cultural Marxism, you can't then... complain if people say this language is not dissimilar to the language used, you know, in Germany in the 1930s. You actually can't complain, because Kultur Bolshevismus in its, you know, in its original form in the 30s was an obsession of the period. You know, they had these degenerate art exhibitions. You know, these guys have painted this. We saw a bit of degenerate art last week in MoMA, Murph. Some of these nonsensical, you know, what is this? I don't understand what this is. You know, why can't they just paint this properly? You know, that degenerate art that they ended up making a big exhibition of to say this is how not to do it, that was their, you know, an example of cultural Bolshevism, Kulturbolshevism, which they talked about. I mean, Suella Braverman uses these words. Now, I mean, that you know, that Mephisto, the movie that we myself and Kira are a two person fan club of, the movie was, or the book, it's based on a book that was published in 1936 by Klaus Mann, who was the son of Thomas Mann. So 1936, like, he's right there in the sort of the Nazi heyday, let's say, and the story is all about, it's kind of irrelevant, I suppose, to this kind of story is, well, it's to do with an actor who, you know, he's successful, and he's kind of he's sort of successful in the sort of radical left-wing underground theater scene, and then the sort of Nazis come to power, and a lot of his friends have to then run away to, you know, places like the Netherlands and France and so on. But actually, you know, and he does it as well at first, but it turns out that, you know, they kind of like him as well and think he's a good actor, and, you know, is it really that different? And so he kind of comes back and, you know, he becomes successful. And then, so it's all about his sort of moral journey, let's say. But I remember a scene in it where he meets this guy, Caesar von Muck, who is this awful guy who we've met earlier on in the story. You know, everyone understands this guy's awful. You know, he's a Nazi playwright, and he's just been appointed to be the director of the Staatstheater by the Minister of Propaganda, who isn't named in the book, but obviously is Joseph Goebbels. And so he's now a powerful cultural gatekeeper. In other words, Hendrik Hufkin, our central character, who was based on a real person who didn't like this book, by the way, when it came out, he really thought this character isn't exactly what happened. But our central character has to go and meet him and do a bit of brown nosing. You know, because obviously this guy's now in charge of the Staatstheater, and if you want to work there, this guy's got to basically... you know, take that off. So he says the playwright had given Hufkin, who had always rejected his plays, an icy reception. His face with the steel eyes and pinched mouth had the expression of unapproachable severity and dignity as he said, "I don't know whether you'll settle back in with us, Mr. Hufkin. There is now a different spirit than the one you were used to in this house. Cultural Bolshevism has come to an end." Here the writer of the Tannenberg drama stretched himself threateningly. "You will not have the opportunity to appear in the plays of your friend Marder or in the French farces so popular with you. Now, neither Semitic nor Gallic, but German art is being made here. You will have to prove, Mr. Hufkin, that you are capable of helping us with such sublime work." So, all I'm saying here is, when you're using language like that, and then someone says your language is not dissimilar to that used in Germany in the 30s, bang to rights. You know, it's
I kind of feel like 1931 was also in the 30s, you know? 1933 was also in the 30s. I mean, you know, Nazism didn't, like, land fully formed in 19... 38 or something. No, do you know what I mean?
No, like, I mean, it's
before
Anschluss,
you know, like 3 weeks before Anschluss, they win a thumping electoral victory and decide, right, here, lads, this is what's going to happen. This is how we're going to do things. Like, the decade was pretty long, and the Nazis were in charge for pretty much all of it. The
decade went all the way back to 1918.
Yeah. yeah, it's just...
But yeah, it's like this... The idea seems to be that, you know, in order for a comparison to be made about your rhetoric to the rhetoric of that time, you know, you've got to be wearing a uniform and speaking German. You know what I mean? Like it's just sort of... Like, what like that's... The cultural Marxism is something Swella Braverman said a while ago. I mean, she didn't say it, okay, to do with this migration bill. But what she talked about was like, there's 100 million people out there who are displaced because of conflict, and they're coming here. Let me be perfectly clear. They're coming here. She stood in the House of Commons and claimed that there was 100 million refugees on their way to the UK unless she did something about it. And the people over there, here's another point. The people over there, the opposition, that is, are betraying hardworking British people. That's the phrase that she used about Labour in her Daily Mail piece, which was launching this policy just a couple of days ago. Right now, that's you know what she's saying. She's pointing at her opposition, saying these people are engaged in a plot against the real people of this country. Right now, I'm sorry, but there's another rhetorical. It's not just the case of we actually disagree with you about immigration. You know, I know that there are all kinds of arguments and you think this evidence is important and we think that evidence is important. But, you know, we respect you, but respectfully, we've got like more votes than you in this house. And so that's we're going to put through this bill because we think this side is more important. But, you know, fair power, all power to you for making a good argument. No, it's like this is a plot against it's a betrayal. Right, that's this is where these rhetorical similarities come in. The left are attacking our profound elemental values, wanting to replace them with the poison of identity politics. I mean, you know, again, it's an attack against the people, like the or her, you know, talking about overwhelming the refugees coming, sort of overwhelming us, and all this
an invasion
an invasion. You know, this sort of militaristic metaphor. Now, I'm sorry, but again, you know, if you look at the rhetoric of that period, and I'm not saying this is the only period when such rhetoric was ever used, and part of the problem maybe is the poverty of the range of possible historical allusions. I mean, I've always been impressed whenever I've been in the UK of like the book section in W.H. Smith's is just all about World War II. it's amazing. It's just like this obsession that never ends with World War II, because obviously World War II and in the sort of British mythology is like the ultimate we are the good guys story, you know? So it's got this, and there's good guys and there's bad guys and we're the good guys and the bad guys are these guys in, you know, high boots and black uniforms and that's the ultimate manifestation of evil. And you can't possibly, but actually there are rhetorical similarities here. And, you know, and the case, I suppose, has to do with, you know, again, it doesn't happen all at once. I mean, there's another thing I was reading recently. I was reading the Tolstoy diary, you know. It's quite long, so you can dip in and out. And I think he's having a pop. I'm not sure. He may be having a pop at another Russian author here, but he says, the description of a struggle between good and evil in a man who is attempting to do or who has just done an evil act has always seemed to me unnatural. Evil is done easily and inconspicuously, and only much later does a man become horrified and amazed at what he has done. You know, it's not like you think at the time, well, I'm about to do this really evil thing. You know what I mean? even the Nazis weren't thinking this. You know what I mean? So there may be a problem in terms of there isn't enough kind of awareness of history outside that to make another comparison. I saw Stephen Bush, the Financial Times columnist, said, you know, one problem I have with this is why talk about Germany in the 30s? Why not talk about Britain in the 30s? You know, in Britain in the 30s, there was also plenty of this sort of rhetoric. I mean, also, obviously, you had the British Union fascists. You know, you had like the king. The king was pretty sympathetic to Nancy. You know what I mean? Like there was a bit of an establishment rot situation going on there. So I think this is maybe one of the problems that Britain has is that sort of hyper awareness of, you know, what went on in World War II and the crimes of Germany, and a sort of lack of awareness of almost anything else in history. So maybe this is why people end up making comparisons because they're not aware of other equally relevant things to compare it to. But, you know, I can see also people saying, well, this is ridiculous. It's so alarmist, you know, to suggest that you know, we're on that kind of a track. This is just a migration bill. This has got nothing on what actually happened there. And, you know, so it's a hysterical kind of comparison to make. But if anyone doubts the power of incremental change over time to really transform things in ways you don't expect, imagine going back to 2015 and telling some of these guys who were tweeting, telling a bunch of these people who I saw on Twitter on Saturday night after that ridiculous match of the day, or not match of the day, football highlights program.
We'll talk about that after. Yeah, go back
but,
to.
But
yeah.
those people say, "Well, this is much better." Like John Redwood or whatever, saying, all the goals were in, and you had good replays to understand what had happened, or some ridiculous MP whose name I can't remember talking about. Oh, this is the best match of the day ever. I was able to get down the local. None of this woke nonsense, you know. None of the pundits or the you know, and or people like Martin Daubney saying this was great. And imagine going back to 2015 and telling any of these guys, in 8 years' time, you will go on Twitter cheering the cancellation of Match of the Day, right? You will be saying, isn't it great that we didn't play a Match of the Day? Ah! You know, that's the position that you have sort of painted yourselves into by a series of small steps over time. Like, it's literally there, like, you know, sick of sitting around the dinner table with your family. You know, have all your nutrients in one easy-to-swallow pill. You know, it's much better. You know, you don't have to put up with the wife wittering on with the woke nonsense she's been reading in The Guardian. You know what I mean? It's just one easy-to-swallow pill. You know, this is literally the kind of mental process. Like, it's just all of these people are just like the Shelbyville, you know, lemon-sucking guy pretending this is great.
I much prefer the vegetable stall when there's only turnips on sale. Who wants to walk around the vegetable store wondering which vegetable to have
turnips.
You can just have as much turnips as you like?
Absolutely.
And then you can get on with the rest of your day without having to worry about whether it's going to be a carrot or a cabbage or a turnip.
The most versatile route, you know.
Just get the turnips.
Get all
in.
The bases covered with turnips. That's the kind of mentality. But you see, it's like a football mentality. You know, that's the kind of funny thing about it. Like, it's like, oh, my team, the way that fans will twist themselves into whatever mental contortions in order to justify the outrages committed by their team. And that's the way that actually people look at politics, which I think makes it sort of, you know, the thing about the BBC's guidelines is that even before they introduce that little extra element governing, like, the big fish presenter who isn't, you know, the big fish sports presenter, Lineker. The Lineker clause, right? Before then, their guidelines, and still the guidelines don't apply as stringently to people involved in news, current affairs, blah blah blah, as they do to those, apply more stringently, more strictly to people involved in news, blah blah blah, than if you're doing sport, or if you're like, I don't know, Jamie Oliver, is he on the BBC, or, you know, if someone
Jeremy
like
Clarkson
that,
or. Yeah.
Jeremy Clarkson. I mean, see, this is the other problem we had. The massive, the obvious hypocrisy. You know what I mean? Of like, you have people like Andrew Neil, or, you know, there was a bunch of different examples of these people who...
Yeah, too many to mention. I mean, it's bizarre and stupid anyway.
Who are going to say... So Alan Sugar was another one, who will say things which are blatantly politically or partisan, in the same way that Lineker's thing is, just in a different direction, which is more agreeable to the government. You didn't have, like, the common sense group of MPs against wokery writing letters demanding that they be forced to apologize. You know what I mean? It's just crazy. So in so many different ways, like, so first of all, what I'm saying is I think Lineker's thing is defensible. The way that he's phrased it, not dissimilar to language used in Germany, or by Germany, he says, I would have said in there, in the 30s, is that that's defensible. That's a defensible thing. In my opinion, to say, and then for them to come down so heavy on him, oh, we're not yielding to political pressure. Well, you know, I mean, okay, you're going to say that, but people will have to make up their own minds, as they do when you present the impartial news. You know, that's the idea. But the whole idea of impartiality is sort of thrown into also an interesting relief by this because...
Well, this is something, because what you said there, you mentioned how sports figures are... Sport is dealt with separately to news within the BBC, within those guidelines that you're talking about.
Yeah.
And really, that as you point out in the Irish Times today... It kind of makes the point that sport, the whole sport and politics, not mixing. You know, yeah. it's different coming out of a sports person's mouth. When actually, I mean that's obviously such an antiquated notion in the first place.
Yeah,
it's almost hard to know where to begin with that.
Yeah, I mean the idea is basically it doesn't really matter what the kids say in the playpen. You know what I mean? They can sort of, that's fine. It's a playpen. Everyone understands that doesn't count. But there are so many different reasons why that's not true anymore. I mean, there's the politicization of the increasing sort of politicization of sport, as you know, vividly demonstrated with the recent World Cup. You know, which means that if you want to, if you actually are involved in commentating on sport, you now kind of have to also at least understand the political context or be aware of what's happening. I'm not saying necessarily that you have to be as vocal as somebody like, for instance, Gary Neville. You know, Gary Neville, who goes on and I mean, during the Super League thing, there were moments when he seemed to be approaching a position where he was against the institution of private property. Now, I'm sure that, you know, he is at the end of the day a millionaire property developer. Maybe he wouldn't have followed that through to the end, but like he, you know, it was extremely political. For instance, obviously Neville is working for a different organization, a private organization. They're not involved in this constant battle with the government over their funding. You know, the government saying, well, we're going to shut you down, you've got to stop saying this, blah blah blah. You know, they're answerable to their corporate bosses, which isn't to say that they're impartial or unbiased. It's just their biases are different, let's say. You know, and this is the sort of interesting thing that reveals about the BBC. The BBC would like to be like, we are impartial, sort of, you can trust us. We don't sort of answer to any bosses, unlike, for instance, any of these other news organizations that you can see. If you look at all of the top rated news shows in America, they're all like massively partisan. You know what I mean? Like, they're just like, there's a madman shouting on the screen, right? That's the successful format. That's the one that gets most viewers. Like, Tucker Carlson, actually, he's not number one because I was checking this. There's something called The Five on Fox where they get like five madmen to, or mad people to come on. These people aren't mad. Why am I saying mad is a stupid way to describe them? But let's say they're all on Fox, right? you know, Tucker Carlson has been up there for years. You know, it's impossible to imagine a more partisan, less impartial show. You know, Hannity is there. You know, Rachel Maddow, people like this. You know, so that's kind of what evidently gets ratings, right? That's the format that gets ratings. I'm sure there are lots of sensible shows where they sit there and calmly discuss the issues, you know, on this, on the one side, on the other hand side, and if we look through this prism, it says this, and you know, but they're not visible in the ratings, right? If you look at like the internet, I mean, who's the main internet broadcaster now? Is Joe Rogan, right? I mean, the man is like he's not impartial. He is not. I mean, he claims to be, but he's not, and he's not. He didn't get to where he is by scrupulously employing journalistic rigor and standards, let's say, right? He's offering something else, okay? Now, I'm not saying the BBC should do that, but you are kind of left scratching your head going, what is it that they can do? The problem with what they've done here with taking Lineker off is that it makes them look like they're kind of like Fox, except that instead of it being the Murdoch family, It's the British government or the British state that ultimately decides what's allowed to be said and what can't be said. You know what I mean? The BBC is trying to be something other than that, or kind of trying to that's what it's been, I suppose. But really, this, when something like this happens, it's like, it's actually the government. You're like Fox instead of the Murdoch family. It's the British state. Like, who seriously believes in the world that the British national broadcaster is an impartial organization? Nobody, I don't think anyone really believes that, regardless of what the charter says or regardless of what they aspire to. People just don't believe it, because I don't think anybody really believes anymore in the kind of idea of impartiality. You know, it's like you're always going to be colored by some kind of an ideology, you know, you're always there. It's always going to sort of, it's always going to be there. I mean, how do, it's like Peter was saying, on Thursday, like impartiality is kind of an abstract principle. So you can only approach it by like the practical measure of balance, you know, we've got people on saying, the climate is heating up, but here's some other people saying, actually, that's, you know, it's not really happening, and we'll get them both on, and then that's impartial. It's not, it's just nonsense. You know what I mean? Like, what's the point of it? It's stupid.
Lineker's statement, by the way, says today, after a surreal few days, I'm delighted that we have navigated a way through this. I want to thank you all for the incredible support, particularly my colleagues at BBC Sport for the remarkable show of solidarity. Football is a team game, but their backing was overwhelming. I've been presenting sport on the BBC for almost 3 decades. I'm immeasurably proud to work with the best and fairest broadcaster in the world. I cannot wait to get back in the Match of the Day chair on Saturday. A final thought, however difficult the last few days have been, it simply doesn't compare to having to flee your home from persecution or war to seek refuge in a land far away. It's heartwarming to have seen the empathy towards their plight from so many of you. We remain a country of predominantly tolerant, welcoming and generous people. Thank you, love heart emoji. So there are a few things there. You know, he's certainly not backing away from his comments or offering any sort of apology or anything like that. And he is expressing, unsurprisingly, support for his colleagues who did show solidarity, starting with Ian Wright.
Yeah.
Who I think once I saw the Wright thing, I thought, oh,
that's right, changes everything.
Yeah.
It changes
what's going to happen now? Because whoever sits there is going to, well, hang on a second.
Yeah.
So you're okay with how they're treating Lineker?
Yeah.
And then it really spiraled over the course of that 24 hours or so. Like, just everything getting axed and things getting cut down and shut down was remarkable, really.
Well, it's a key moment of the whole thing. Is Wright.
Oh, right.
Right, yeah, because obviously it's not something that Tim Davie expected when he did this. Because this has been a massive embarrassment for him. The weekend of programming was essentially cancelled or replaced with nonsense. And he's had to now apologize to everybody apart from Gary. He doesn't name Gary Lineker, but like, you know, the apology is like, I apologize to everybody, all the people who work here and our audiences. Now, there's no way that that was in his plan. Right? This is not a position he wanted to end up in. Like, oh God, I've had to reinstate the guy and apologize, not to him, but to everybody. And I'm saying I didn't, succumb to pressure and all this kind of stuff. But the thing he obviously didn't expect was something like what Ian Wright did. If Ian Wright says, I'm not doing it, suddenly it's over to you, Big Al. You know, what are you going to do? You know? And like, I mean, and Shearer, what, you know, what's Shearer going to do? Like, is he ultimately, I mean, it was funny also to see the speculation about who would be the person who would break
out. Well, they may have spoken about it as well, Wright and Shearer. I don't know.
I'm sure they did.
Spoke about it, but what I'm saying is it was very close together. So I don't know if that was just a timing thing that it was, but certainly Wright, the first person to do it is the one who's looking like they're the one making the stand. But
and then everyone else is like, well, yeah, okay, this is captain, you know, standing up in their desks or whatever, and that's solidarity, you know. It's obviously not something Nick Davey expected to encounter. I thought we got rid of that. I mean, I wouldn't say that it was necessarily it would be bulletproof and would last, you know, if he was prepared to drag this out. But I think it became sort of ridiculous because
it meant they had to get this sorted. You know, they couldn't just leave, because you can leave Lineker on ice for the rest of the season if you want to, you know. It's not ideal because the story would keep growing legs, but you can't leave the whole bloody sports department on ice, which is what was going to happen.
Yeah.
If they had left Lineker, if they let that situation go,
it would have been fine.
Later on this week, it would have been, okay, so what's going to happen next week? Surely, because you can't just be in solidarity with Lineker 1 week. You have to stay that way. You have to back what you're doing here. So are we going to get, we have weeks and months of this horrendous attempt at a Match of the Day that we saw on Saturday, for example.
It's much better.
All the other live sport.
No,
I have
nonsense.
Heard quite a few people say that. No. Oh, it was a tough. It was a. Well, I think I had to watch it. I was curious.
It was hilarious. It was honestly, it was such a daft thing to sit down and watch on Saturday night.
It did
night.
Have the kind of feel of like this is. It's like sort of reminiscent of some of the COVID thing. You know, the kind of unreality of it. Like the thing about it is,
well, what Ken, sorry, it was much more. I know I've cut you off a couple of times here, but you know, I did let you do your half an hour monologue. So, it was a lot closer to what you were looking for out of COVID football. You remember we used to have this dispute between us where I preferred to leave the fake crowd noise on, just maybe made it feel a bit more like what I'm used to. You were like, no, I want to watch it without the crowd noise. Yeah. It's how it actually is. You know, this is obviously how football is.
Well, you know me, I just verite.
I know, but what you actually got a better sense of that this time. This is actually what you're looking for during the lockdown football, Ken, because you actually do hear a real crowd. You hear they're very short, but you know, you see a football match being played in front of a crowd, just with no commentators ruining it and no annoying presenters. You know, I don't want people to be too fond of what they saw on Saturday and Sunday, because you know, they might start to question this artifice around the game.
Oh yeah,
presenters, for example, are they necessary? Yeah, commentators.
Well, I mean, is there not? Can you not already do that? Like, switch off all the comms and stuff on red button.
Can you
not do? Oh no, but mute, then you don't get the crowd.
Oh, sorry.
Is there a version that you can already get?
Maybe depends on what your provider was.
But like, whatever about a live game, when you're watching highlights, you kind of need the commentary or the sort of stories in order to kind
story.
Of to what's yeah. What am I paying attention to here? It's like rather than just a series of unconnected dramatic events with no apparent connection to each.
It's like watching a hurling match on the Sunday game. Highlights show where they never throw up what minute things happen in. So you're just like, oh, okay, that seems important. Does the crowd seem, oh, but what? There's another point? I still don't know. Okay, I know what the score is, but I don't know how much time is left. Therefore, this is just happening in a complete information vacuum.
Substitutes as well, Murph, because there were no graphics. The only graphics that would show up during for anyone who didn't watch it, probably a lot of people, there was no intro music. So it wasn't matched. There was an apology. Everyone's apologizing, except for fucking Lineker, huh? Everyone else is apologizing. The continuity announcer's like, really sorry about this. But match of the day is going to look a little different here. We don't have any commentators. Football highlights program coming right up for you. There's no music, which is the first jarring thing. And then you're just into this like graphic saying Premier League highlights. Then into the first game, which was Liverpool, I think, on Saturday. It's just an abrupt segue from game to game with that little Premier League graphics thing coming on screen for a moment. But there were no graphics at all. So for example, right, Arsenal last night, suddenly Gabriel Jesus has the ball and has a shot. That's a pretty massive story. Just as they're closing in the title, he's back. Did he start? I had to go up and check afterwards. Did he start the game? No, he came on as a substitute. So yeah, you absolutely don't get the story of the game. And also, personally, I like Pep after a match being rude to interviewers. I like the analysis sometimes. You know, I feel I do get something out of it. I learn a little bit more. And there was none of that going on. It was just like, here's some football.
Yeah. No, it was so overall.
2.6 million viewers can't be wrong though, Ken. The viewership was up.
Yeah, the viewership was up. Of course it was up. Like, I mean, people have been talking about it all week and everyone wanted to see what the sort of freak show was gonna look like. You know, I mean, that was why people were watching. That was why it went up. I mean, the people are like, oh, the match of the day figures aren't that big. You know, what was it, 2.6 million viewers? I mean, you know, that's not far off what Tucker Carlson gets. And he's on $35 million a year. So, I don't know. Maybe that is the private sector. I suppose Gary Linker's unlikely to be working for Fox anytime soon. Maybe he's more of an MSNBC guy. I don't know if they're on that. They go up to the sort of $30 million range. But people complaining about his $1.3 million. When you see what some other people are getting paid for, well, not really a huge amount more, it seems like, well, is it really?
To be fair, right, it probably wasn't the worst weekend in the world for this to happen from BBC's point of view.
It was amazing, right?
It wasn't vintage. It wasn't really vintage Premier League. It's not going to be too many Premier League years moments being showing too many of these games in decades ago. Maybe Casemiro's red card.
Well, imagine it had been next week. I mean, they're doing all the FA Cup next week. You know, it would have been 10 times worse. Just from a what are we actually going to do situation, but the Premier League, a good weekend for Arsenal, Man City hanging in there, Grimley hanging in there, Casemiro. Oh my God, this is incredible. The man has never been sent off before, and he gets sent off twice in like what, three games? It's like he's now. So I think he's been available for 20, or rather, he's been at the club for 20 matches when he could have been in the squad, 20 Premier League matches, and he has already served 4 matches of suspension and will serve the next 4 in suspension. So I think it's, what is it? Okay, so it's 8 of his first potentially 27 matches, because he wasn't in the squad the first time, the Liverpool game, he will have missed due to suspension, which is phenomenal. I mean, they're Luis Suarez numbers. You know, this is like, how have you managed to achieve this? This is incredible. For a player who has never received a red card playing in the Spanish League.
At the height of Let It Flow. I mean, imagine what would have happened if he'd moved over 2 seasons before.
And it's so random. Like, I mean, you know, there was that Sabitzer challenge the other... You remember the Sabitzer one on Wout Faes? I mean, you know, that was... It seemed worse to me than Casemiro. But, you know, that's fine. That was nothing. And then this is a straight red. And because it's a second straight red, it's a 4-match ban. I mean, if you look at his last few matches, you know, he missed the Arsenal game because he was suspended for 5 yellows. Came back in, got sent off, missed the next 3. Came back in. I can't remember which game it was. But then there was the 7-0. And then he gets sent off in the next game. And now he's out for another 4. It's absolutely incredible. Is he doing anything different from what he usually does? No. He's just been randomly punished twice in a row. He's like a lottery winner. He's just won the lottery in consecutive weeks, except it's bad.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
It's a beautiful summer's day. The breeze is stupendous.
Stupendous. Stupendous.
Would this podcast be even more stupendous without ads?
Without ads?
Ads. If so, then join us for daily commercial-free shows at secondcaptains.com for just €5 a month.
I don't know what you're talking about.
I'm not bumping them up. I'm not Irish. I'm just saying my observations, they are amazing.
Stupendous.
Thursday, September 14th promises to be one of the biggest nights in Second Captains history. We're celebrating 10 years live at the Olympia Theatre in Dublin. The Olympia Theatre, guys, it's going to be ridiculous. The show is a complete sellout thanks to our incredible World Service members. Advance notice on live tickets. It's just another perk of World Service membership. And it's a busy week this week for our members. Another 2 football pods to come. Stephen Kenny has a squad announcement for the France game. Real versus Liverpool in the Champions League. Build up to the Grand Slam match against England.
Wow on.
Yeah. Secondcaptains.com.
It's exciting.
€5 a month plus VAT. Thanks, Ken. Thanks, Murph.
Thank you.
Thank you, Owen.
Thank you, Kieran.
Thank you, Ken.
Thanks for listening. Don't forget the Second Captains podcast is part of the
ACAST. The ACAST Creator Network.
ACAST.
Which one is that? That's the second time it's gone off.
They never go home, those boys.
The Second Captains
World Service.
It is not war and death and famine. It's not that at all. It's the opposite of that. It's to persuade that there's a world outside of that. That's why sport's important.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight. and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.